So we're back with another episode of In a Perfect World, and I am your host, Rak Razam, and I'm very pleased to have with us today Joshua Wickerham. Joshua, you've been involved in, the NGO field for quite a few years now, and you've come into the ethnobotany field with your latest project, which is the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council. Could you just tell us a little bit, about yourself and what you're doing with the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council?
Sure. Thanks, Rak. It's really a pleasure to be here. Glad we could make this work. My background is really in the intersection of accountability and sustainability. How do organizations become more accountable to their stakeholders? And how do they integrate sustainability into their bottom line? So I focus on social issues, environmental issues, and economic issues. And although I'm American, I've spent a third of my life, the last 10 or 11 years, working in China and Latin America and Europe, a lot on sustainability standards, these international voluntary standards that handle things like fair trade and organic and various commodities, the Forest Stewardship Council for sustainable timber and forest products, marine products, etc. And the bulk of my work is still in China. I'm in a way kind of a lobbyist for sustainability standards in China, kind of work to illustrate the benefits of these standards for transforming various agricultural sectors or sustainable tourism, the benefits they can bring, as well as working to make Chinese-led standards more trusted and more understood, more accountable to the rest of the world for the benefit of all, hopefully. So what I'm working on with the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council is assuring the safety and the sustainability of traditional plants. Especially these iconic species like ayahuasca, peyote, iboga, that have that are often used in a ritual context and may touch upon tricky social and environmental issues where there's cross-cultural contact.
You know, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Joshua. There are some tricky cross-cultural issues, aren't there? And what I find very interesting about your work, I must say, it's a really refreshing. It's just very refreshing that you exist and that you have this focus and you are bringing that into this community. It's a global community, the ethnobotanical field. And, you know, I guess for many years, if not decades now, we've had our scientists and anthropologists and sort of that more academic background of people. And then there's been on another very tactile grassroots level, there's been this rise in reinterest in shamanism and what I call the global shamanic resurgence. And there's been, you know, seekers who are experiencing the dimensions that entheogenic plants and sacraments can open up. But it's been always difficult sometimes for this left-right brain hemisphere or different facets of the community to come together and to work on, you know, the mechanics of this as an industry as well as a spiritual pursuit. And so I think it's great that you're here and what you're doing with the Stewardship Council, because it's helping to bridge the gap between different facets of the community, not just recognizing itself as a community, but dealing with a lot of the those tricky social issues that you mentioned.
Yeah, that's right. I spend a lot of my time thinking about very rational economic and social issues, but it ultimately comes down to people, how you work with people, how you build consensus on different issues. So it's a pleasure for me to be able to bring some of these professional tools into a new area for me in some ways. And it all depends on working with the community. So appreciate the chance to talk to you about this and kind of get the message out to people.
So tell me, Joshua, we've met a few times. We met at the MAPS conference in April in Oakland, the 2013 Psychedelic Science. And then we met again in the UK at Breaking Convention. And both times at both venues, there were some community focal points and discussions or around the ayahuasca community and about the growth of it and about the management of it. And it seems to be that at this stage of ayahuasca's coming back into the cultural mainframe, that, you know, the teething issues and the growth issues have become very public to a degree that, you know, we need to be working on these things in-house as a community, or it will be legislated against from outside. But you were involved in both those sort of strategic dialogues with the community at those events. What's your impression? Like, if you have much experience with the community, you know, in general, and what's your impression of the entheogenic community, I guess?
Well, I got started in this in this community sort of through the internet, like so many people in the late 90s, which were kind of, you know, secretly psychedelic, and the works of Terence McKenna and Best Friend and I. So we were explorers on our own. I wish I'd had more community support back then, taking these heroic doses, as Terence McKenna called them, which to us, that was my first initiation into the space. And I sort of I have never put plant teachers aside. I've always been an herbalist from my earliest memory, and always used plants. But I sort of came into this space through Psychedemia, the University of Pennsylvania conference in October of last year. I figured a conference sponsored by an Ivy League medical school was sort of a good time to get our feet wet and meet some people. And so that's when I first started hearing people like Steve Bayer and Dennis McKenna kind of talking about some of the safety issues around ayahuasca. Steve Bayer has that blog post, "You can't dial 911, you can't call an ambulance in the jungle." Just being prepared for going out in the bush. And Dennis was talking about some of the sustainability issues around ayahuasca. And then it was at Psychedemia that I met Rick Doblin, and he invited me to do some consulting for MAPS on their strategic plan, their sustainability plan. And so he invited me to the conference in April, and that's when we had that gathering of, there must have been 200, 250 people in the room that you helped moderate. And I was stunned that there were so many issues that I'd never considered. And I'd heard the stories about people that had died in Peru under, you know, inadequate supervision during ayahuasca ceremonies. But I didn't realize the extent of stories about sort of inappropriate touching, or what's perceived by visitors in Peru as inappropriate touching that may be appropriate in some cultures. So these are these cross-cultural issues, but then issues of rape, or just some basic things that are endangering the reputation of this important traditional medicine. Mm. So at that time, I was talking about an ayahuasca sustainability initiative. Jim Fadiman and Bia Lavate and Dennis McKenna were really important early supporters of the work, and they introduced me to a lot of people in the community. And then Rick Doblin of MAPS said, "Well, why don't you set up the nonprofit with as wide a mission as possible," sort of like he did with MAPS. And started hearing stories about peyote sustainability and iboga, this African root that's very, very good for treating addictions and all sorts of things. And not just that, but other plants like cat's claw, uña de gato, or lots of Amazonian plants are starting to receive a lot of attention from markets for export or for healing in Peru, etc., and are under threat. So there's a lot of work to be done. And then Catherine McLean, a friend of mine, that she's does the psilocybin and meditation research at Johns Hopkins. She'll deny that she said this, but she she initially said, well, why don't you apply some of the things that you do professionally to this ayahuasca space? You talk about moving your profession closer to your heart. And so I started thinking about this, and that's when this all started coming together. And then we had that session at Breaking Convention, and we realized that talking about a standard with the community, sort of, people don't. I emphasize that we're creating a multi-stakeholder initiative to build consensus around safety and sustainability issues, rather than, I usually talk about standards, but standards set off all sorts of alarm bells about, you know, five guys in a room setting a standard and not consulting with anyone, when in fact, from the very beginning, we've been consulting with as many people as possible. And what I mean by a stakeholder is anyone who could be affected by this initiative or could affect this initiative should have their voice heard. We should proactively reach out to them and be responsive. It's my pledge of accountability to the community to be as transparent as I can and to be as responsive as I can. So anytime anyone writes something on the ESC website or makes a suggestion about we should talk to this person, I take that really seriously. My credibility is it's the most important thing to me. So, and then we officially launched the ESC at the Reform Conference in Denver, hosted by the Drug Policy Alliance. And they gave me a scholarship to attend, and they're interested in this, in the policy angle, in the, can the community around ayahuasca, I say self-regulate or community regulate, and as you know, in London at Breaking Convention when we got together, a lot of people said, well, we don't like this word regulation, but it comes down to, if we don't do something as a community, then the Peruvian government or Brazilian government or Ecuadorian or Colombian governments are, for the sake of their own tourism, for the sake of their own reputations, could in the coming years develop some sort of heavy-handed legislation. Mm. Even though ayahuasca is recognized as traditional cultural heritage at the national level in Peru, there are just so many warnings from your government, RAC, from other governments saying, tourists beware, it's an unregulated market. Mm. And the more we can do something, and I'm not talking about, you know, forcing anything on anyone, this is a totally voluntary initiative, but the more we as a community can come together and have dialogue and discuss what are the basic safety and sustainability issues and how do we assure that an organization that says it's sustainable and safe, we're talking about like an ayahuasca lodge or retreat center, how does it prove that it is sustainable and safe once it says it is, if it agrees to the eventual consensus that we develop through the ESC or through working with other groups? Because it's hard to know right now. It's all based on who said what and reputations, which are important.
It's a bit of a hornet's nest, Joshua, to cut to the chase there. I mean, you know, there's, as you say, there's the difficult cross-cultural issues, and I think it's wonderful that you have the freshness, and I guess some might even say naivety, to jump into that hornet's nest, because it doesn't need to be done, you know, and it's not as if, as you say, you're projecting any set rules, all these regulations on people hierarchically. It's about, I think you're coming from a very good place from what you've told me in our meetings and looking at your website. It says that, you know, you're bringing your learnings from the NGO community in your global application. And I think a lot of those are very good, because many people mightn't even understand what an NGO or a non-governmental organization does. But, you know, within its the boundaries of its organization and your mission statement, it really is engaging with stakeholders, and it really is, it's almost providing that nodal point for the rest of the community, the stakeholders who already have, you know, attachment to these issues, to have that voice, to have it heard, and then to be actioned in a way that, you know, vested interests and all the opposing groups and all the in-house sort of fighting and the brujeria in South America and just the politics, you know, in what we call the scene, I guess, it needs to be sidestepped, and we need a neutral voice to help facilitate that. And I think that that's really the potential of what you're doing.
Yeah, we hope so. And we don't take sides. We don't point out bad behavior. We're just creating a space where people can step into the light of accountability. If they want to voluntarily associate with this.
And it's true. I mean, I guess we'll get into the nitty-gritties in a minute, but I mean, I guess that's what's happened with other I guess, products, let's say, in the global marketplace, whether you have free trade coffee or, you know, properly harvested, you know, materials. This whole idea of sustainability, or having some proof, or having some you know, energy there that people can recognize that there's a label, or recognize that there's some accreditation to it, really, really will help in the long run. And in some senses, what I feel like it's doing is, like, we've, you know, the community for quite a while now has recognized that there's this business of spirituality and this business of shamanism happening in Peru and all through South America when it comes to ayahuasca. And, you know, it is booming, and it is booming back in the West as well, and it's booming throughout the world with different entheogenic plants. There's this, regardless of who we call ourselves seekers and we want to remain on a spiritual frequency with our language and with how we're interacting with these medicines, in the larger meta level, there is a trade going on of both ideas and of materials. And, you know, the dynamics of commerce cannot be escaped, you know, and the dynamics of what's going on in the integrity of this business cannot be escaped if there's a lack of it either. So I think in some levels what this is really doing is it's crystallizing what's already happening with the right language from the NGO community to help facilitate us basically not just into a global marketplace, but almost you know, pulling our socks up or being a more mature approach to it as adults and as a global citizens, I guess. So let me just read something from your website. So the Ethnobotanical Council is ethnobotanicalcouncil.org. And just on your front page there, you've got the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council is a non-profit organization dedicated to assuring that sustainable and safe use of traditional plants and enriching the communities who work with them. So that sounds all good and well. And I think embedded within that, there's at least three pronged difficulties there. You've got things like sustainable cultivation, sustainable centers, safe practices. Let's just talk about that first one, this idea of sustainable cultivation. Because I remember when you were first, you know, first broaching this idea of maybe just being the ayahuasca sustainability initiative, and you've got this embedded thing within the Stewardship Council now of one of your main projects is to have the ayahuasca dialogues, which I guess is, you know, taking on board that the energy from the ayahuasca initiative. But so let's look, when we talked with Jeremy Nabi about this at Breaking Convention in July, his very astute you know, feedback was that, okay, so you want to have a sustainability initiative eventually for all entheogenic plants, but in the first iteration for ayahuasca. It's beautiful because it needs to be done. Ayahuasca takes up to 7 years to grow to fruition, you know, and, you know, the longer the plant, the vine grows, the more chi and the more energy and the more, you know, magic I think it's going to have in it. But, you know, from what I'm hearing on the ground, especially around Iquitos right at this moment, is that there is so much demand from Western gringos descending upon Iquitos that the curanderos and the gringo shamans are having to go further and further out into the jungles to harvest ayahuasca to keep up with the demand. And also, it's not just that people are going to South America on the gringo trail of the soul, it's that a lot of the curanderos are now exporting ayahuasca to their customers, you know, through the internet all around the world. And so there's that extra, you know, baseload weight put on the ayahuasca vine itself in Peru. I actually heard anecdotally from a friend in Iquitos that the Iquitos post office is no longer allowing ayahuasca to be sent, you know, because usually what people were doing is they would send it in or they don't no longer send it in glass bottles, but they'll use plastic bottles. But, you know, ayahuasca can ferment inside there in the heat of the Peruvian, conditions. Quite often bottles would burst. And so there was so much leakage happening in the Iquitos post office that they've just totally, they know very well what ayahuasca is. And for many years now, it's been labeled as cat's claw, Yinayo de gato, as you were mentioning before, for export. But the people of the post office know what's going on, and they just totally, it just won't get out anymore. That's what I've heard, that it's just creating some very, very real dynamic logistical issues just in even on that level, and it's getting to be really well known. And so just tell me about this idea. So what is your idea of how can ayahuasca be made to be sustainable within this onslaught of the Western gringo demand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure how legal it is to sell ayahuasca in bottles and export it, but it is legal to sell the vine. And you're right that there are some sustainability challenges. I think, on the one hand, the market will take care of demand to some degree, because there's money to be made. People will harvest the vine. But you hear stories about people going 2 or 3 days into the jungle and they'll find a mature vine and they'll cut down a tree, an old tree, and it'll topple 5 other trees and they'll harvest the vine. And it may be really powerful ayahuasca, but that's not sustainable and that's not good for the forest. There's no way to stop that. But there are ways to recognize the providence of ayahuasca. And I take inspiration from the convention on the Convention on Sustainable Biotrade, or the Biotrade Principles, that when you're harvesting a traditional plant, there are 7 principles of sustainable biotrade. You have to focus on the conservation of biodiversity. And the nice thing about ayahuasca is it's a vine, so it has to grow on other trees, other plants. So if it's cultivated rather intensively in the forest, it can actually help preserve the forest. It can help preserve biodiversity. It can be a bulwark against other forms of unsustainable development. And equitable sharing of the benefits derived from the trade in biodiversity is another principle. So sharing with the communities that harvest in an equitable way, paying them living wages, that sort of thing. I mean, the devil's in the details. How do you prove where the providence of a certain ayahuasca vine, who picked it, how they were treated, etc. And one option is to work with cooperatives, like cacao, chocolate is grown in cooperatives, and the people can send their kids to school. They have basic health and sanitation improvements, and you can tell where the vine is grown. So when I was in Peru in July and August, I visited some cooperatives that are doing reforestation projects. They're planting medicinal gardens, and they were setting up a maloca for ayahuasca ceremonies. And they hadn't realized that ayahuasca was legal to export, and they were already planning it. They'd already planted some ayahuasca vines. But when I told them, there could be the opportunity in 2 or 3 years after we work on establishing consensus through the ayahuasca dialogues, if there's market recognition of a label or a claim on a product, they could see a market premium for sustainably harvested fair trade ayahuasca. And they were like, well, why are we planting only 1 million vines? We should be planting 2 or 3 million. So there's this growing recognition among people in Peru that, wow, this tradition that we've neglected over the last few generations is really important, and at least from an economic perspective. There are other ways of sourcing sustainably and in a fair way. A lot of sites that I visited, a lot of centers or lodges will work with their curandero and their local community to plant ayahuasca and to make sure that they're propagating. Or Una de Vegetal, one of the ayahuasca churches, has this principle of for every vine you cut, you plant, I think, seven more, at least seven more. So those sorts of, it's easy, it's, you know, not, there's no way to say, okay, this site uses only 100% sustainably grown ayahuasca, but there can be checking into where the ayahuasca is grown, and it can and be kept anonymous, so competing places wouldn't be sneaking onto the property and taking ayahuasca. But it's really about involving community and getting people don't, I mean, the field of sustainability standards on which we're building the ESC, a lot of it's rather technical and complicated. I try not to use too much jargon, but traditionally, these claims about sustainability and things have been made through certification, which is a kind of visit once a year, twice a year from an auditor, from a certification company, and it's a kind of snapshot in time. But there are new ways of assuring access for people, so it's not a cost barrier. By involving more local community actors, more NGOs, there are lots of NGOs springing up in Peru. There are lots of traditional communities that can be involved, and it was pretty exciting for me to go down and talk to people about the sustainability and safety issues, where their food comes from, and you know, this is sort of the beginning of a resurgence in permaculture and more sustainable ways of growing crops, growing food, medicines yep. in the jungle. I take inspiration from like Kat Harrison talks about how before the Incas colonized the Amazon, it was home to millions of people growing mound gardens in harmony with nature. And we can start building that. I see the lodges or the retreat centers as sort of beacons of consciousness in the Amazon of trying out new and sustainable methods.
That's a polite way.
Getting reconnected to the earth.
Okay. That's a polite way of describing the lodge system, Joshua. Yes. Let me just ask you as well, though. Jeremy Narby, you know, said this funny thing when we were dialoguing about this at Breaking Convention. He's like, well, that is all good and well. There needs to be a sustainable approach to ayahuasca, very, very much so. And it's like, is there any difficulties in you know, categorizing an entheogenic plant? You know, like he's saying this isn't the sustainability of mangoes we're talking about here. It's ayahuasca. It's a very powerful psychoactive sacrament, as well as this baseline sort of mechanical approach to harvesting, you know, sustainability, the assembly line, accreditation. It's actually got this spiritual component, you know. And did you find in your travels to Peru that any of that element, you know, would affect how you approach this initiative?
Yeah, I remember that comment at Breaking Convention that the most important stakeholder is the invisible kind, just making sure that that invisible landscape is kind of behind you.
The spirit world, Joshua. I mean, what you know, Mother Madre Ayahuasca must be the primary stakeholder in all of these dialogues.
Yeah. So, I mean, ayahuasca manifests herself in different ways. And at one point, she kind of manifested herself as these very lovely forest animals. And
so this is with your experiences, yeah?
Yeah. And well, I was...
Okay, well, just backtrack, because you went to Peru for the first time just a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, previously you had not done ayahuasca, even though you were, you know, involved in this practical business level of setting up the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council and the ayahuasca initiatives. You had not drunk ayahuasca. So all the machinery of this organization was setting it all up, but you had your first experiences in Peru just recently. So, you know, tell us a bit more context about going down and what you did there.
Yeah, well, I'd had offers to drink ayahuasca in the States, and based on my experiences with psilocybe mushrooms in college, I wanted to do it in a traditional context. I'd had friends that had gone to Peru, and they said having a trained guide is really important. So it does come down to these human dynamics. So I visited many different sites. I spent 45 days there. Started in the Andes in the Sacred Valley, Dennis McKenna's invitation, and had amazing experiences. I felt very comfortable in the space, felt very familiar. And I went down into the middle Amazon, upper Amazon, and the lower Amazon, and just based on recommendations from people, I wanted to be safe first. And I talked to the owners of the different lodges. I talked to the shamans and curanderos, and I came away feeling that this is possible. And it's not my job to promote ayahuasca, but it is my job to protect the plants and work with people to protect traditions. So we're coming at it from that angle.
All right, that's a very valid and a very safe answer, Joshua. Now tell me what happened to you emotionally and psychically and what you encountered with the spirit of ayahuasca.
Well, I'm afraid of snakes. And so the first thing I encountered were cobras, you know, like a sea of cobras, a bed of cobras. And I made my peace with the serpent world, and it was slightly scary. And I revisited a lot of childhood scenes. I became friends with death in a way that I hadn't been before, because it's true, this, they call it the vine of the soul, traveling into what feel like ancestral realms or spirit realms. And a lot of it was hard. So I started to say that ayahuasca manifests herself in many different ways, but she manifested herself one time as, and it's hard to know what's the plant and what's you, but anyway, meeting in the middle, it was, you know, this sense of a strong yet somewhat vulnerable forest creature that wants to work with people, wants to help people, but needs our protection at the same time. And so I sort of made a pledge that I would do my utmost to protect ayahuasca and her allies. And it was at that point that the work started. It was like, okay, now you're really going to deal with your issues. And it was like being cleaved in half psychically. And there's no escaping. It's a 5 or 6 hour situation, sitting with your past and your future and your own mind and your ancestry. Mm. So, you know, I'm
interested.
I feel like it's still working on me.
Yeah, I'm interested in this, but I don't mean this facetiously at all. But you know, we mentioned earlier that you know, Madre Ayahuasca as an entity, as a valid stakeholder, should be engaged in the dialogue process. So, you know, it sounds like that you did that, and that was the first point of call. But do you think that you would? This is the difference of worlds we're talking about: the academic, the NGO, the business world, and the spiritual world. And so, you know, you're providing a very valuable bridge between these worlds. And on your own personal experiential level, you know, I think you are also going to have to engage with the stakeholder of Madre Ayahuasca on a regular basis. Do you think will you do that?
Definitely. Oh yeah, I'm getting my schedule set for next year. How many days can I spend in Peru and elsewhere? We're in the middle of a crowdsourcing campaign, taking donations on the website for the beginning stages of the ayahuasca dialogues, and we want to hire local researchers in the four countries where we have to get this right: Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru, as well as hiring hopefully a native Spanish speaker to kind of coordinate the research and get the initial sort of details of all the issues on the table for then a full stakeholder engagement session. I've been invited by Alan Shoemaker to go to the Iquitos Shamanism Conference in July. I think that's important to engage with people in at the heart of the booming ayahuasca trade in Iquitos face-to-face. So I'm definitely planning I'm going back and continuing to engage with this most important stakeholder. And I want to go back to your question or your comments about how do we make this work. I want to say that I, and Jeremy Narby's comments and others, that it's tricky in the details. I engage with all these sustainability standards, and I ask the CEOs of the standards. Some of them are from Latin America. Like, what do you think about ayahuasca or San Pedro or peyote? And they don't think about that. They see it maybe as a reputational risk or something. And I am ready at this stage in my life to be more public about plant teachers and working with plants. So it, details about like brujeria or witchcraft or dealing with claims of sexual assault or other things, I mean, those are not the traditional areas of a sustainability standard. So working out those details will take a lot of community engagement. Okay.
Yes, it's a difficult one, and so you brought up this idea of safe practices, and that's it's a whole other kettle of fish. So, like, sustainable cultivation, I think people can grasp the idea of it, and it makes a lot of sense. And I think there's a lot of support there without any political agenda or without any, you know, there is a vested interest of people to support that, to support ayahuasca remaining sustainable and the industry remaining afloat. When we get to safe practices, it sounds on the surface that it should be supported as well. Everyone wants a lodge system where people, there's a basic duty of care, that there's a basic understanding of, you know, how people need to be nurtured and catered for and supported. But I think if you haven't found it already, that, you know, when you get into South America and to get into the macho culture and how that trickles down into the curanderos and to the in-house fighting, I mean, for more than decades, presumably for centuries, there's been, I guess, this intertribal sort of, you know, some level of either warfare or, I mean, there's obviously been cooperation as well, but there's a lot of fighting, there's a lot of macho energy, that the way they engage with this is they don't trust each other, and curanderos on a very basic level always seem to be deflecting the brujeria or negative intent from other curanderos and spending a good part of their time cleansing and preparing and their defenses and getting ready for the next wave. And so you mentioned Ellen Shoemaker, and for many years Ellen has been a leading proponent or calling for basically similar things to what you're doing now, of this idea of maybe a council of curanderos or some type of accreditation system for the curanderos. And, you know, I think he's received a fair amount of feedback and criticism on that idea, but also the political workings within that and the machinations of that, and how would that be set up in a neutral way, because there's so much vested interest and there's so much, you know, backstabbing or just sort of, mm-hmm. you know, climbing and leveraging against each other that does happen on the ground, that it's difficult to find that neutral playing ground. And it's also difficult to deal with issues like, here's these Western NGO coming in and setting up some type of playing field, and who are they to say? And, you know, as you say, you've got to engage with the stakeholders, but when the stakeholders it's just like global politics, isn't it? It's basically a microcosm. You've got to find a way to make all the players get along to the degree to make this work, because it is in the best interests of the community and of the industry at the same time.
Yeah, well, I don't want to impose anything on anyone, and if I inadvertently do or come across with that, I'm conscious of that, and I want to take a few steps back and make sure I'm doing the right thing. I respect what Alan is doing. I think he's got a system set up to receive complaints if people file a police report of something that happened at a site that can be investigated. And I emphasize the voluntary association with the ESC because if people want to be held accountable or if they want to work on sustainability and safety issues, they should be, there should be some recognition of that. And if if there's a violation, then it should be investigated. And we're taking nominations for people that could be on a council eventually, that could investigate claims and make, at least that's what we're thinking, some sort of like an ombudsman function. But there are other ways of doing this. And at a basic, you know, objective sort of scientific level on safety issues, getting away from some of the infighting and personality, you know, clashes or whatever, a lot of sites will have an intake form or some way of evaluating patient readiness, like psychological state, or heart conditions or physical ailments, or whether you're on an antidepressant that could interfere with, that could kill you if you take ayahuasca. And the science around that is pretty mature. And I've talked to a lot of people about that. And so one of the early goals that we want to have with the ayahuasca dialogues is a kind of open source intake form where we take the forms that sites are using now and combine it into one document and do a thorough stakeholder engagement process where there's an online ability to comment on the form. And because there's a lot of holes in retreat centers evaluations of people, and that could open people up to dangerous situations.
Joshua, do you know what that makes me think of, though? There's just so many layers to the onion with this, because from what I understand with the legalities in Peru, the lodges, usually traditionally in the last 20 years or so, the lodges are fronted by Western money, and there's someone who is, you know, deriving income from the business of the ayahuasca lodge who is a Westerner, and it's usually, you know, in concert with a curandero. And because of the legal system in Peru, 51% of the lodge or the land is usually owned by the curandero or an indigenous person to keep that legal fulfillment there. But it brings up all these ideas that, you know, some would say of Western imperialism or of going in and, you know, it's like, it's very difficult. I've known curanderos who have tried to create their own lodge. And, you know, traditionally the role of a curandero is basically, you know, it's basically like the village GP. It's like the general practitioner or a doctor. It's like, you know, the average curandero has not been a wealthy person. They've been people that have really serviced the community, and it's only the last 20 years or so, as the money's been coming in from tourism, that some curanderos have strategically taken advantage of that flow of energy. But, you know, for every rock star curandero, like maybe Guillermo Arevalo, or people who have had that leverage to build a very, you know, very public lodge for Westerners and get that magnetism going with it, there's got to be at least 100 curanderos that just struggle along, have been serving the community. And I've seen this drift even in the last 7 years or so, where people like, say, Percy Garcia started off, you know, the first Amazonian Shaman conference, he was still treating his local community. By the time of the second Amazonian Shaman conference, when I went, he was migrating towards, you know, Western customers. And now, and he's a very good man. He still has a very good reputation and is one of the better people I still recommend people to go to. And so there's no fault here, but what I'm saying is there's this drift to serving Westerners over local people. So the whole lodge system is sort of skewed to this Westernism and to servicing Westerners, and the money behind it even propping up the lodge system. So then I wonder, with that backdrop, you know, how the lodge system and how this integrates into your vision, and how these stakeholders who have authenticity and who they would be on this ombudsman type council, or, you know, everyone basically has a backstory and a hidden history and a vested interest. And it's no different in the West, but especially in Peru and in South America, it's like the whole system is already skewed and geared towards those who have the money. So the average curandero who's struggling to get their own lodge, they're probably going to also struggle to uphold the whatever sustainability practices or whatever guidelines or whatever general things are set out. It's going to be the ones who have the resources that are going to be able to fulfill them and then get the accreditation and get the, you know,
let's unpack some of these things. I want to go back to accreditation first. Any you could have a Freudian psychologist association that, and I talked to a lot of people about can you accredit curanderos? And the answer comes back from lots of fields, no, or it's very hard to do so. It's easier if you're a religion or if you have a specific, subcategory, but it's too hard to do that. And I don't think it's my place or the ESC's place to accredit per se. And then I think you're also getting to the question of access to being recognized, to be able to make a claim using the ESC kind of rubric, like we had adhere to the principles of the ayahuasca dialogues, something like that. And there's a balance between access of a site to being recognized by a standard and the rigor of being able to make that claim. So the most rigorous sort of certification and sort of continuous monitoring of compliance takes a lot of money, and that would exclude people who are just starting up, as you say. But there are other ways of gaining access, like a self-declaration saying, I like the consensus that's been developed through the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council, or and I'm working in my individual capacity to live up to that. There would have to be some degree of oversight on the safety issues, but we're thinking of a star rating system. So like a 1-star for someone that makes a self-claim, up to a 5-star rating for someone that's invested to get sustainable, to be safe, have all the safety things in place,
Joshua,
and to be recognized.
You know what that means, Joshua? You're saying there could be a 5-star shaman.
It doesn't...
I'm sorry,
the claim is not about the shaman's performance. It's not about...
I agree. I'm being a bit disingenuous, but I'm thinking it's interesting because it brings up the language that we're applying to this, and it's basically shamanism is having to move forward into the 21st century as a business as well as a healing modality, and so some of the language around this, trust me, the audience and the people out there will start using the term 5-star shaman if they haven't already, and it just also brings me around to this idea that there was a very recent article, I think just last week, in the LA Times, and you had a bit of a write-up in that as well, and they mentioned this idea, which I think is what you're talking about now, this whole idea of sort of a trip advisor for shamans. And it's an idea that's been bandied about for a while. And I know my friend T-Fairy has been saying at conferences here and there for quite a while that she wants to have an iPhone app for shamans, which is basically the TripAdvisor of a rating system. And it's to a degree, I think it would just be formalizing what ayahuasca.com forums and the community is already doing with moderation and with peer review. And this seems to be the key in other businesses, like if you look at, Amazon.com or eBay or any of the sites which have a degree of trust when there's a product sold and the community is self-regulating and ranking and feedbacking, how they've gone with that participant or the person they've trusted, the thing. It does seem to be the next logical step.
And for the record, I never said TripAdvisor for shamans when I was interviewed for that article, but it kind of, some degree of community feedback is important, like a grievance mechanism or a complaints mechanism. If there's oversight from the community on these forums and with the ESC, then claims can be investigated, claims of unsafe practices. But I think it's not the ESC's role to take on comments about the aesthetics of a place or how powerful a journey was for someone. I think that's sort of more of the TripAdvisor space. We're focused on the technical issues of sustainability, the community engagement, and the safety aspects. And I, back to your question before, I think the best sites, even though they may cater to Western tourists or to people from the cities, they're still open to the local communities. They may offer free care to the local communities. That's my personal assessment. I think providing people access to their traditional medicines is important. So if we're, as we're developing, as we're, as ayahuasca develops into an even more global phenomenon, that keeping its base true is important. And I think the ESC, after much work with the community over the coming years, if we're successful, we'll be able to assure people that the ayahuasca they're buying or they're taking, the sites they're visiting, are making communities stronger and robustly responding to the needs of the communities.
Mm.
There's some other issues that you brought up that I was thinking of unpacking, but as you know, I'm a bit jet-lagged.
That's okay.
Trying to convince myself that it's... anyway, it's
well, as I said
travel
before,
to the other side of the world, so it's a 12-hour time difference on day two.
You're a busy man.
But I'm not as clear as I usually...
No, it's okay, because as I said, this is like an onion, and there's many, many layers to this, and it's not as if we can... They will be solved in one fell swoop. It's what I see basically happening is that this is a generational mission, really. Is that, you know, we are the generation now that is re-engaging with the shamanic sacraments and reclaiming, you know, a sense of worldview, a sense of Gaian worldview of how we are embedded in the web of life. And so this very you know, lateral and very practical approach to the NGO management of ayahuasca and ethnobotanical plants needs to be done. But as we've mentioned a couple of times, you know, that's one half of it, and there needs to be also that appreciation and contextualization of the spiritual component and of all the extra levels to it. And it's a very complex subject, and there's a lot of you know, complicated cultural, cross-cultural issues, as you've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And
educating people, I mean, that's half of it. And Jeremy Narby was saying fair trade ayahuasca is different than fair trade papayas. For that very reason, people need to be informed. So we're building on what's out there. There's lots of different guides and initiatives that they're building organically. And
yeah,
I mean, it's not my... I just wanted to add that it's not really my role to offer what I think is the best. It's my... There's a Chinese saying of you throw a brick into the water to attract the real jade, meaning I'm just throwing this brick into the water to attract, to uncover the real gems out there. It's really what the community thinks is important. And so I'm offering an option for people to engage building this consensus. Yeah. And it will take years to get there, and it won't be perfect the first time, and not everyone will be happy, but we endeavor to be responsive and to continuously improve as time goes on.
Beautiful. Well, just tell me a little bit about, because we're talking about, you know, as you're saying, it's like you're creating a nexus point for discussion and for community engagement. And you've also partnered with some other organizations, like you mentioned MAPS, and there's ICES as well. It's great, because I think you're adding a level of value and differentiation that is needed, and it sort of, you know, complements these other organizations, and then there's going to be role for even other organizations to really fill all the gaps. But how has that been going with this partnership with these other NGOs?
Yeah, I want to mention PRISM too in Australia. They're a supporting organization. ICERS is an incubating organization. When I first met the executive director, Ben DeLonen, he instantly understood what I was doing, what we were working on, and the importance of it. ICERS stands for the International Center for Ethnobotanical Education, Research, and Service. They're registered in Amsterdam, but their main office is in Barcelona, and they're setting up an office in Uruguay, given the policy changes in Uruguay. And they found the designers for the beautiful website that we set up. They've invested their own money to get that going. They've been commenting from the very beginning on all the content and leveraging their networks. They're also taking tax-deductible donations from Europe that will go to this initial crowd fundraising campaign that we have to get going. MAPS is acting as a fiscal sponsor in the U.S., which means they can take tax-deductible donations. And MAPS, Rick Doblin, the executive director of MAPS, has appointed I think he used to work for Goldman Sachs, a financial advisor to oversee the books. And we have a chief financial officer that's administering contracts and things. So it's all by the book and being overseen by professional people.
Hey, Joshua, do you think people at Goldman Sachs do ayahuasca? Should they?
I think so, yeah. I don't think capital and ayahuasca are incompatible. I think capital is value neutral, and it can be used for good or it can be used for evil. And when used wisely, it really can change people's lives, can improve them. So, I mean, I think also entheogens and ayahuasca especially connect people, or have the potential to connect people with nature and the consequences of their actions. So,
very good answer, Joshua.
Flying around.
Very good answer. I'm very impressed. Because you are going
to
be a lightning rod.
Try to be diplomatic.
Yeah, you are going to be a lightning rod for many different, communities, perceptions, and energies, and so that was a bit of a loaded question, but you handled that very well.
We're trying to create a big tent here. I think it won't work without a big tent approach, and we don't all have to get along all the time, but we can sort of hold our noses if we need to, and be constructive. I think it comes down to that. It's one thing that working in China for the last 10 years has taught me is being constructive is very important. Building trust, building right relationships.
Yeah. Well, you're doing an amazing job, and thank you for stepping into this role, Joshua, and I hope it all goes well. Give us is there a direct link to your crowdfunding campaign, or is it just on the website?
It's just on the website, and we kind of rushed to put the website together ahead of the Reform Conference at the end of October, so we'll be adding more details of what we want to spend the money on. I'm successful with my day job, my sustainability consulting work. I'm donating my own time to this. I'm not making anything personally from the crowdsourcing campaign. And I'm paying for my own travel for this initial stage. So this is really money that will go toward hiring local researchers, hiring someone to oversee some of the research, to put together a report and all the components of what's the market size of ayahuasca? What are the opportunities? What is the best way to make sure that the Ethnobotanical Stewardship Council is an accountable organization to its stakeholders? And so we can interface with environmental organizations, foundations, others that may not see the environmental benefits as easily as we're seeing them. I mean, I think for a lot of people in the ayahuasca community, the safety issues may come first, but the sustainability issues are just as important. We can't have dialogue about one without the other. It's building the capacity of communities to grow ayahuasca sustainably. It has these spillover effects of them working with other plants in a way that's more aligned to their traditional way of working with them. So
just on that level, do you think, I mean, you've been to the Peru once, and I guess, this is, as we say, it's a many year sort of journey to make this all happen. But the consensus on the ground is that the indigenous shamanism is rapidly changing. It's already had many waves of change with mestizo shamanism in Peru. And now the Western influx is creating this supply and demand, and everything is just transforming very, very rapidly. Is there any issues that you touch upon here of, of legacy or of helping, retain tradition or also even retrofit tradition? I mean, is that within your bailiwick?
If it's important to the community, I'm value neutral about it. I think it's important to preserve languages and cultural traditions to understand these traditional ways of seeing the world. And they're probably hidden medicinal gems and techniques and things that are on the verge of dying out. And the more we can recognize practices that help preserve these traditions, the better chance we have of learning from them. So time is running out on that front. And if people have good ideas about how that can be integrated into the consensus we're building through the ayahuasca dialogues, then please contact me through the website or just email me at joshua@ethnobotanicalcouncil.org. It really depends on people's involvement.
Mm.
And we're involved with, like I said, we want to build on what's out there already. There's Plantaforma that has a guide to safe rituals. There's iSears has a guide to safe rituals. Steve Beyer, there's different conventions and laws and different alliances out there. And some of them are more specific to certain religious persuasions or take a very specific definition of what ayahuasca is. And we're trying to be as broad and accepting as possible. So our definition of what ayahuasca is in the Ayahuasca Dialogues is not so specific. It's not just ayahuasca plus chacruna. It could be toe, or it could be other admixture plants. I think what's important is that people know what's in the medicine that they're taking. Informed consent, these sorts of things. Again, this is my personal opinion. I'm just thinking about what's feasible to be able to assure or certify or make a claim about. It's easier to make a claim about this vine is yellow ayahuasca or black ayahuasca and it came from this forest rather than this bottle of something that's being shipped out of not the Iquitos airport now or the post office but somewhere. You know, that would require like chemical testing or something. That's pretty hard to do. So it's a mixture of what's feasible and what's important to the community.
Yeah, beautiful. All right, Joshua, thank you so much for your time. It's been really great to chat with you. And I think for a lot of listeners, this will be a very illuminating discussion because it does touch on so many, different facets of ayahuasca coming into Western usage and of the growth and of the sustainability and the safety and moving forward as a spiritual culture as well as a business.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your time, Rack. I really appreciate it. We touched on certainly not all of the issues, but hopefully I've left your listeners with a sense of what we're trying to do. It's a work in progress.
Yeah,
we really want as much feedback and participation, not just donations of money, but donations of time. We're trying to run the organization as kind of Quaker leadership philosophy as possible. And if you see you have a role potentially to play, you have some experience on the ground or this or that, I mean, I want to try to make a place for people to get involved. So,
well, Joshua, by the way, I would love to help in any of these ayahuasca dialogues in any way in the future, you know, when we have either community meetings or online discussions. I think that, you know, I'd love to help facilitate that. And I see on your website, ethnobotanicalcouncil.org, towards the top there's a very well-defined subscribe to your newsletter field mm-hmm. box. And so, yeah, I think that's probably a very good way for people to get involved, you know, to help support the organization financially, but also, as you say, to help to become involved and donate time and ideas and to help start, facilitating this movement. This would be great.
Well, thank you, Rack, for your personal involvement and for the plug there. You're a great facilitator. And I look forward to future dialogues with you and the rest of the community, whether it's online or in person or wherever we end up.
All right. Thank you so much, Joshua.
Thank you, Rick. Be well.